Ready to take your verdicts and jury selection to the next level? Jury consultant Harry Plotkin and trial lawyer Dan Kramer are your ticket to tipping the scales before trial begins. You're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Hey there. Today, we're doing something special. We've compiled the best strategies and insights from the first 12 episodes of Picking Justice. The insights could change your next verdict. Let's get to it.
I mean, there's cases where you're going to need a lot of cause challenges because you may have a really tough issue, you know, like your plaintiff was drunk or something like that. And you're like, okay,
yeah,
you know, your plaintiff was on meth or something like that. But it's like one of those things, you see the guy at the gym who's got like, you know, a huge right arm from doing just curls with his right arm and his left arm is puny. It's like, I just see a lot of lawyers who would just like, they're developing this like cause muscle and like neglecting the other parts for voir dire, which is just like actually listening to your jurors and assessing your jurors and trying to figure out who's actually maybe okay for you. And so like, I remember in that case, it was a pedestrian case, but sometimes there's like lawyers are so focused on like every, what is it? You know, if you're a hammer, everything is, you see is a nail and like, let's just try to get everybody and make the case sound terrible. And you start to get some, starts just kind of snowball sometimes. And you get like even good jurors saying like, I guess I can't be fair because it sounds like this pedestrian wasn't paying attention. And like, so if you're the lawyer there and you're like, in this case, like she was paying attention, like she wasn't out of the crosswalk. And, but some lawyers are just thinking, hey, if I just kind of don't correct this juror, I'm going to get more cause. Like, okay, tell me more about how you feel. And that's, you couldn't be fair. And we're right behind, right? And more jurors are hearing this, even your good jurors. And they're going, wait a minute. You know, if Dan is not addressing that, it sounds like he's kind of agreeing that like this pedestrian wasn't in the crosswalk and wasn't paying any attention. And maybe they were on their iPhone or earbuds are in or whatever. And you start to just to kind of lose good jurors.
You think they could be good jurors. You think that they have the capacity to award a significant amount of money in the millions of dollars or whatever your aim is, but they're very hesitant about money for that. They don't understand it like most people don't, frankly, and they don't understand how they could do it. And so when they're a little hesitant on them and they're not someone you really want to attack for cause, you just kind of throw, you know, well, let me ask you, is there, do you think there's anything more valuable than the loss of quality of life? And, you know, they always pause and almost every time they'll say no, or if one does kind of hesitate, or even one that may be decent is like, do you think loss of quality of life could be worth more than a lifetime of paychecks or a mansion, a yacht, or any material thing we could own? And then, so you kind of just, you get that discussion going, which is all this stuff I've gotten straight from you, Harry, which is just great. But that's, I've really changed that because I think before I would approach, you hear millions of dollars for pain and suffering and that rubs a lot of people the wrong way. Does that rub anyone here the wrong way? And I still may do that sometimes in a different way, but I think that would be sort of the way I would introduce the subject.
When we're talking about the human harms and losses, we are asking the jury to put a value, appraise the value of that individual's harms and losses. But if that person, if the jury doesn't relate in some way to that, if they don't know what it feels like or they can't imagine someone taking something of value away from them, then they really have no purpose. They can't serve their purpose on the jury. So when we talk about harms and losses, I want people to start thinking about the things in their lives that are priceless, that are invaluable. Even if I don't ask them directly, and a lot of times I will ask them directly, what's important to you? What does good health mean to you? And what do you wake up every morning hoping you can do? Who do you look forward to seeing? What do you want to do when you retire? What would be one thing that you would want to be remembered for, right? Those sorts of things. I want them to really start getting into that, feeling it. So then when we start talking about damages in the case or the losses in our case, the jury can't help but think, wow, what if that were me? What if you took away my ability to dance? What if you took away my ability to sing? What if you took away my ability to hold my child? What if you took away my ability to travel? All those things, they start to really say, oh, wow, that's major. I believe in my heart of hearts, every case that I try, the jury wants me to win. They're rooting for me. They are rooting for me. And so as I'm looking at these people, help me win. Help me. I do believe that most people like me. Most people want to be around me. Is it true? Doesn't matter. It's what I believe. And so I move with that energy. And what I have found is that, yes, they do. Nobody wants to see me struggling. And you don't want to lie to me because I'm not lying to you. I'm honest. Can you be honest with me? Like, it really is that. And so I have found that we have to just explore what it's like just being around people, being comfortable around people. If you can't talk to people, why are you trying cases? If you can't talk to people, why are you trying cases? Give it to someone else. I do this because I love the work. I believe it is righteous, good work. And I genuinely like people. And I think that people genuinely like me.
I always say there's really two things I want to accomplish at the end of jury selection, and especially after the end of jury selection and opening statement. And number one is I want those jurors to look at me as a reliable source of information. This is a person I can trust. He's not bullshitting me. He's not overselling. He's not underselling, and he's honest. And number two, I don't think you got to pick a good jury necessarily. What you want is an open-minded jury, and that is a good jury. You know, get rid of the haters and be left with 12 people that truly, truly come in with an open mind, because if you got those two things, you're probably going to win the case. But in terms of establishing credibility, it's your first impression. And it's like any other interaction you have with people in your first impression. Are you polite? Are you nice? Are you dressed appropriately? Make sure your shoes are shined. You're respectful. And, you know, just be a normal person and don't be too lawyer-like, because generally speaking, I think, you know, jurors come in, they don't really trust lawyers, and it takes time to develop that trust. And you want to start off on the right foot, especially with the first impression. So I'm in trial with the jury knowing there was a 100,000 insurance policy where a carrier did a lot of things right, but not everything. And there's one critical thing they should have done, that phone call. And we are now asking for $7 million plus interest for that conduct. And the jurors I wanted there are not the warm and fuzzy kind of jurors. I wanted the cold accountants, engineers, people who have precision in their profession, that if you screw it up, you pay the consequences. And I didn't really use the analogy for in voir dire, but it kind of like, you know, if you have a pilot who has a 100-point checklist and he does 99 of them perfectly, but he fails to do one thing. And then when he's 5 miles up in the air with 135 passengers and he clicks on the landing gear, oh, that's the one thing I didn't check and it's not working, and there's a disaster, are you going to say that conduct was reasonable? And now you have to analogize flying of a plane with the importance of how you deal with a time limit demand. And in that profession of insurance, it is. It's a one-time opportunity to settle a case to prevent exposure to their insured. So you have to educate the jury on that. But the mentality is jurors who are very, like the accountants, engineers, who are very anal retentive, are more the jurors you're going to want. Because you don't need them to give you money. The money's there. The judgment's there. They get to hear about all this. So it's a very different kind of approach depending on the case.
And so here's the beauty of jury selection. Jury selection is about what you make it about. You get to pick the topics. And so what I saw a lot of attorneys doing is they didn't know what to do. Have you had that feeling in voir dire in the first few cases you tried where you're like, oh my God, like, what am I doing? Like, what? I'm up here now. They're all looking at me, which is fine. I mean, I'm not afraid to give a speech. It's fine. I'm not nervous about that. I'm nervous about the fact that I just don't know what I'm doing right now. I don't know what to do. What am I trying to accomplish? What am I doing? And so after going through that a long time, and I have a lot of associates who wanted to try cases and they're like, teach me what to do. I'm like, shit, I don't know what to do. And so I came up with this foolproof method that I employ every time now. Of course, I put bells and whistles on it, but just to make it super simple, like my notes here, I just hand wrote them to show you how simple it is. Here's what I do. Number one, let me flip this around so you guys could see this. Don't be a dumbass, as they say. Choose your topics that you're going to voir dire on wisely. Choose them wisely. Don't ask about bumper stickers and stuff like that. I don't know, Harry. Sometimes judges shut that down. You know, the books you read, the news you watch. Yeah. Do I want to know if you're a Republican or a Democrat? Yeah. I mean, yeah. I tell them, I say, folks, we've come to a part where I'm here for money. It's no secret. I'm going to ask you to compensate plaintiff. And you could use any variety of phrases or terms or whatever. I'm just cutting to the chase here. And at the end of the case, if I'm able to prove that such and such is liable and they did something that, you know, was negligent or they shouldn't have that caused this injury, and you hear about how horrific it is, which you're going to hear about. We heard juror number six's, you know, juror number six talk about her mom's recovery. It's going to be similar to that, except, you know, it's a little worse because it was caused by an actual accident. I'm going to ask you to award money to compensate them for things like, and then I'll go through the human harm. I don't like the pain so much. And some of them say, is this pain and suffering? I say, yeah, it is. You hear that phrase, but that phrase is unfair for me to use here because it's so much more than that. And then I tell them the other words, anxiety, loss of enjoyment of life, disfigurement, you know, all these different things, emotional distress, all these different things that are on there. And I have a list and I read the ones that are applicable from in California, KC3905A. And I'll tell them that's what it is. And I want to ask you folks, some people believe that using money to compensate for these forms of losses, as I've described, is appropriate. If you turn your head and you feel pain, that's going to happen every day for the rest of your life. You should get money for, you know, be awarded money for that if the defendant caused it. Some people feel money's not going to do anything. It's not going to make the person better, et cetera. You guys all know the spiel. And if you don't, you can find it anywhere. It's all the same thing. So I ask, first, I'd like to see a show of hands of those people that can award money and are willing to and have no problem using money, because that's what we have in our civil justice system. We used to do, if you take an eye, I'm going to come and take your eye. Not me personally, but that's what I heard they used to do hundreds of years ago. They get a chuckle out of that, or a tooth for a tooth. That's where those phrases come from. But in our civil justice system, if some harm comes to one of us, we don't go to the person's house who caused it and instill the same harm. Instead, we get them to compensate that civil system of justice so that we all get along and there's no violence.
You know, I think it's important to understand that you have to explain bias a bit to the jury. Because if you go up to anybody, strangers that show up for jury duty, they're trying to get back to work by noon or get home by 12 o'clock, and then they get called to a courtroom, then their name is picked, then they're in the box, and then they're like in the fishbowl, and they sit there, and suddenly you say, hey, how much is the death of a baby worth? They're like, what did he just ask me? What? Death of what? Who? My baby? Who's baby? And, you know, lawyers don't have a feel for what it is to be a juror. And, you know, you have to talk to them and let them get comfortable speaking, warm them up a little bit with speaking, talk a little bit about bias not being a bad thing, that everybody has likes and dislikes. What we're really talking about is, in your life experience, have you come to think a certain way about things that might make you great for the case next door, but maybe not the best juror for this case? That's kind of what we mean by bias. It's, you know, strong likes and dislikes, strong opinions. And I think you need to get people comfortable with talking about how they feel about things. And I know the basics everybody talks about. In the old days, when somebody would say something we didn't like, oh, I think there should be tort reform. Oh, you lawyers, I know you just want, you know, back then it was hundreds of thousands of dollars. And we'd be like, oh, Your Honor, Chambers, let's talk to this one in Chambers. This is a troublemaker. And now, of course, we've learned to thank that juror for their negative opinions we may not like and telling them, well, that may not be music to my ears, but I thank you so much for sharing, because that's exactly what we're talking about. Because you are involved in a lawsuit, sir, you have strong feelings about them, it seems. I appreciate you sharing. And what you said was you'd have a problem with being on a jury that awarded a lot of money because of your experience. And obviously you're working to get cause, but you're encouraging the people to talk. You're encouraging them to say things that we may not like. When I lecture on the subject, what I explain to lawyers is whatever you're asking for, and most of the time you're trying cases, you're asking for either hundreds of thousands or millions or multiple millions or tens of millions or 100+ million. If the jurors, philosophically, based on their life experience, are opposed to awarding millions of dollars, for example, or tens of millions, I don't care how good a lawyer you are. I don't care how good your facts are. I don't care how smooth you are and how artful you ask your questions on direct and how sharp your cross is. You ain't getting it. They don't believe in it. They're philosophically, emotionally, their life experience is against it. You will never get it. So what we're hoping to find is a group of jurors that are truly open to the possibility that millions or tens of millions of dollars might be fair for a particular loss or harm. So I, again, strongly recommend not going into a topic like this that anywhere until, let's say, at least the midpoint of your voir dire or a little more, because they got to be really comfortable. You have to have established some credibility. You have to have established a nice question and answer flow. You have to get an idea for who's who and what's what. And you need to warm up.
I mean, I work with, I would say, often newer lawyers than maybe you do. So I do a lot. I feel like my voir dire help is often a lot of teaching. And I find that the first thing we have to do with something like this is teach lawyers what bias is. Because if they come in thinking jurors are biased, they do that whole dance where they just try to get every juror off for cause, which to me is the most ineffectual voir dire. You know, you've seen it where every question a lawyer asks is just, oh, do you think you can be fair after any answer a juror gives? And that's not the point of voir dire to me at all. And I don't want to funnel everybody off for cause. And I actually think that in today's society, jurors are so ready to be inflamed that they're actually better for plaintiffs. So I don't want to do a whole spiel on bias. And if anything, I have talked lawyers out of the cherry pie example. I'm sorry, I'm being so controversial, but I don't believe in it really, unless you're in a really bad venue. But because of what Harry said, because, well, first of all, I have two things. One, a lot of judges won't give you a ton of cause, right? So that the Keith Minnick style is to get a ton of cause. So you have to know that right ahead. That you, if you're not going to get a ton, it's kind of a not really very helpful intro. But also, if, for example, and I have done, if I have a police excessive force shooting case, generally more jurors would, quote, think they're biased for the plaintiff than for the defense. So if I give a whole cherry pie, I'm going to have tons of jurors saying, you know, I hate excessive force cases. This is my cherry pie. I can't be fair. Okay, I was just going to get on my soapbox for a second that voir dire is not just a conversation where all you're doing is trying to get cause. I really want to encourage lawyers to really think about what their objectives are for voir dire, and because there should be learning about jurors too. And so if you ask questions that are just weird, open and shut, yes or no, to try to see if they hate lawsuits or not, and then just railroad them all for cause, first of all, you're probably losing good people. Second of all, you don't know anything besides that very, very specific black or white issue that you asked about. And you're probably missing a bunch of people in the middle who are probably nuanced jurors who are going to stay on your jury and make the decisions, right? So if you're old, and I see it all the time with, because lawyers are so indoctrinated now that cause is king and this is all you do, where like literally they say, hello, how are you? And the person says, hi. And then they're like, do you think you can be fair? Like it's the first thing they do. And it also gives you a really bad rapport with the jury, I think, if it looks like all you want to do is shove them off the jury.
Well, I think the top trial lawyers all embrace their bad facts and get them out in open in voir dire and have the jurors hear it and get their reaction to it, not after the, you know, they're sworn in. And so that's counterintuitive maybe from old practices of trying, you know, kumbaya and selling your case as best as you can. I don't think you should sell your case in voir dire. I think you should just lay out the issues and then identify all the hot button, negative, horrible issues that jurors are going to think about, whether they're covered at trial or not, because that's your only chance to gauge what their response is going to be.
What is your method for that? Are you one of these that in mini opening, are you kind of just listing your bad facts? Do you weave it into a story and just leave out your good facts? Because I've heard some lawyers, and Harry and I have talked about it, they almost show their case as a really shitty case, even though it is a good case. And then they brag about getting 60 cause challenges and they get defensed.
Right. So you've got to structure your mini opening in a way that you are justified by being in court and that you need these jurors to resolve this dispute, but you're not overselling your case so that you then arm the pro plaintiff jurors with reasons why they're going to get kicked off. It's a delicate balance between not looking like you're just coming in here trying to scam the jury and trying to get millions of dollars on a bogus case, and at the same time identifying all of the issues that they're going to have to confront or may in their head confront that would make them, you know, not fair to your side of the case. Never have your client there. I mean, if you can avoid it, don't have them there. If it's a psychological injury, have your expert explain. They shouldn't be sitting there hearing the negative stuff from the defense expert. If it's a brain injury, jurors just, they're looking for data, and the data includes everything they see about your client, including the negative. Walking in, walking out, did they laugh? Did they smile? What are they wearing? How'd they walk? Like literally, maybe introduce them in voir dire, and then that's it.
Yeah, well, that's what I was going to ask. I mean, I say in a TBI case, from the outside, the plaintiff looks totally normal. Don't you kind of want them to see just even briefly, like, hi, and then have him leave?
Maybe, but I'm against the client being there.
Yeah. Is that throughout the whole trial?
Yeah, until they testify. Jurors, I've never had a juror, you know, the old school thing is, well, if they got to be there, the plaintiff exactly. should be there. That's nonsense. Jurors don't know that.
It really comes down to how much will the money impact someone's life? And therefore, does the amount of money someone's used to having, is that the true value of what happened to them? Or is pain, pain, and pain is equal for everyone? And it's a hard concept, but I think it's a super important concept, because I can't imagine most of our listeners are not representing billionaires or hundreds of millionaires or even millionaires, right? I mean, we're just not. Right. I mean, so we're representing the everyday blue-collar folks out there, or even not, or just people who are just at your average income person, middle class, socioeconomic, wherever it is. But it's just like, is their pain not worth as much? And I think it's definitely a concept. You got to do it. And you just say, like, you believe that someone's quality of life is tied to how much they make. I mean, I think you've given me that question.
Yeah, that's better, because when, like, you would never lead with that question of is a poor person's quality of life worse? Because now you're asking them to say something that I think for a lot of jurors, like, that sounds like an insensitive, controversial thing to say. But you can lead them there. And as long as that first step is like, should somebody's compensation and their value of their quality of life sort of be tied their income or with the kind of money that they're used to? And some jurors will tell you, they feel comfortable saying, yeah. And what a lot of lawyers forget is that, like, you never want to say, like, the juror is the unfair one. It's always like, you flip it around. I always say, like, do you feel like the law is unfair? Because in their minds, that's what they're thinking. Like, I'm fair. Like, a tort reform juror is like, I'm fair. The law is not fair. And so if you try to reverse that, you're not going to get anywhere, because they're just going to say, I can be fair. I can be impartial, you know? And like, because to them, they really are, they're not lying to you. Somebody who thinks that any verdict over $1 million is totally unfair is going to tell you, I can be totally fair when it comes to damages. And they would pass the lie detector test because in their minds, that is fair. So you have to flip that around and say, you know, what are you feeling? Do you feel like any of these concepts are kind of unfair or unnecessary or ridiculous, or these verdicts are excessive? You got to use those negative words about your kind of about your case as opposed to about the juror's convictions. And when you use conviction, it's really hard then for the juror to back off of that when they've said, yeah, those are my convictions, when you're trying to get them. Then take that next step and say, now, if the law is at odds with your convictions, I mean, like most people, you're going to probably side with your convictions, right? And it's not just a little feeling that they have.
The magic of doing what we do is to build a case around the things that make us the same, not the things that make us different. So actually, that's what jury selection is. You've already hit on kind of my whole philosophy of jury selection, is to say, how can we coexist as not a homogeneous group? We can be totally different in our politics, in our thought processes, and all these other things, but we can come together on the things that are necessary to do justice in this case. And those things, I think, are universally the same everywhere. I mean, you can't go to any place in the country, and if you query in the right way, you know, and you start asking people, what are the things that are most important to you in your life? You're going to hear family everywhere. You're going to hear freedom everywhere. You're going to hear independence everywhere. You're going to hear self-determination in some form everywhere. It may come out as a pickup truck in one part of the country and a sailboat in another part of the country, but what's represented by that sailboat and what's represented by that pickup truck are really the same human, deep level kind of a thing. So to me, that's what jury selection is about, is reminding people that we're really the same on the things that matter in this case, and honoring all the differences, you know, kind of making room for the differences so that we can focus on the things that are the same. So I think a lot of us spend a lot of time on the bias questions and a lot of time on questions within the idea of bias, especially on damages, on the idea of, you know, we break things down by saying how many people here have strong feelings about economic damages or about giving awards for money for pain and suffering or whatever those kinds of questions that we've been taught to focus on.
And what I think we forget to focus on, or a lot of people do, is what are you making your case about when it comes to the damages side of a case? So if the case at the end of the day, I don't care what the injury is, TBI, spinal cord injury, even a whiplash, I mean, whatever it is, what are we really making the case about matters. And I'm going there in jury selection. And so here's what I mean by that. We talked about earlier that people are largely the same in most ways, and then there's some ways that in which they're different. But I already know, no matter how conservative or liberal a jury, an area is, I'm going to have differences of opinions on lots of things, but there's some things that are not. So, for instance, take any case, I don't care what case you're thinking about, but if I ask you about if at the end of the day I'm going to be asking for a lot of money in the case, anybody who's going to award a lot of money, they're going to have to award it because what was taken away was very, very important, right? Very meaningful and very important. So I already know what those things are for just about everybody in the whole United States. It doesn't matter where I go. So I've built my case around these universal things.
It's hard to use a specific number and then your client gets impeached 10 ways to Sunday and then try to stick to that number for credibility purposes. So I'll say millions of dollars are substantial and I'll just start the talking process. Last case I tried with Harry, I told him we were asking for like 40 million or something. I forget the number.
Yeah, that was a death case, but yeah.
It was a son that lost his dad. It was a single son. There was it was a loss of a son for his father. And I think kept saying 40 million. And I remember the jurors were talking about it and like, well, yeah, if you prove it, I could give it. And it was just, they said it so many times. And we ended up selling the case right before closing. And the judge went and pulled all the jurors. I'd never seen anything like it. And she asked each one of them how they felt about the evidence. And, oh, we would have done so well. But it was a hard liability case. But anyway, we would have done well. One of the jurors, I'll never forget, he was like, man, when Mr. Simon said 40 million, I'm thinking during jury selection, that's crazy amount of money. I could never do that. And he's like, but then I listened to the evidence and he looked at my client. He's like, I would have given you 40 million. Crazy, right? But if I hadn't laid that anchor, I could have said 50 million, 60 million. I could have said 15. I said 40. And because the jurors do not know the value. But conservative jurors, so, you know, what I do with him is you want to kind of get them, they want to do what's just, what's right. And it's like a piss off factor, right? They want to be able to, it's crime and punishment. If somebody screws up, they got to pay. And if someone's trying to fool you, that's fake news. So embrace it. Be like, juror number, whatever. I always try to remember their names. So, you know, we talk a little about like this with the judge, you know, I just got to ask you, like, you seem like somebody that's a real good, like, BS detector. You know what I mean? They'd be like, yeah, I know what you mean. So I was like, so somebody's on the stand. It might be my client. And you think my client's a liar, a cheat, and a fraud. Could you like say zero? I'm like, yeah. If you find that other side of the table screwed up and they got to pay, will you give them full compensation? Like, will you be able to do that? I'm like, yeah, I think I could do that. And then to start preconditioning them for when I know they're going to have an expert up on the stand that's using junk science or that I know, because you're subliminally telling them, hey, find that red herring. If you find like somebody is just trying to fool you, just write in your notes and take that into consideration. Because I think those jurors really like to have little breadcrumbs and clues. And yes, I'm strategically making them find it for themselves. But if they feel like they came to that conclusion, it really empowers them to do the right thing.
And I see a lot of attorneys doing that. Well, they say, how many people think there are too many lawsuits? And then nobody raises their hand. That doesn't facilitate an open conversation, because what you want, at least from my perspective, is to have the juror feel comfortable enough to talk to you. So I'll ask Mrs. Smith, do you feel that there's too many lawsuits? And then why or why not? No, there aren't any. Because now you're giving them not just the option, raise your hand if there are there? And if you don't agree that there are, why do you feel that way? And then open it up, who else feels that way? Or who else disagrees with Mrs. Smith? So before I would stand back behind the podium and speak to the group as a whole. Now I'm more impersonal. And I think, you know, Dan, you can agree. And Harry, that comes with experience and comfortability in your own skin. Now I actually focus on the person I'm talking to, because that's what we do in conversation. And it makes them open up a little more because they feel they're being heard. The last thing someone wants is when you ask them a question and you want to know the bad things that they're thinking, right? They're vulnerable and you're looking away. I like to give signposts, you know, I'm talking about that. Let's go on this topic and I question them about it. And then, you know, now I talk about how at the end of the trial, what they're going to do is fill out a form. And in filling out that form, they have to decide two specific areas. The easy one is what we call economic damages. It's, you know, numbers that are tangible. You can touch and feel them. You can see them. They're easily articulated, whether it's lost income, medical expenses, actually something that one of our experts and their experts is going to put a specific number on the board. But then there is a more general one, which is called general damages. And then I get into that, you know, and how it's recognizing the loss of health, the amount of money equal to the value of what was taken to that person and how that person values their loss, not how someone else would value that loss. So it's very important that we listen to, you know, the testimony. And then by that time, I've been talking to a few jurors about their own pain experiences or family experiences and experiences with loss, and then get a commitment from them that they're not going to compare the two. That what my client values their loss to be may not be what they would if it was their injury and the way that they deal with the pain. So kind of put the concept that, yes, it's up to them. They're the appraisers. But the eye of the appraiser is not from what they would do personally and what they would want personally. It's from what the evidence that they heard and how my client suffered.
There's no golden one fast rule in this. But I never used to use the cherry pie analogy because I just don't eat pie, period. And yeah. I couldn't find a good metaphor until recently, because I was, when I was trying the last case, it was the World Series, right? You know, I'm a Dodgers fan. If I were the umpire for the World Series, close calls are going blue. And that actually worked well for me, but I usually don't do that. Usually, if I have a questionnaire, I just go straight at it. First juror that I talk to is, I literally just tell them, hey, Mr. Jones, I read your questionnaire. I know you're not going to have a hard time telling me things I don't want to hear. And your questionnaire scared the hell out of me. Do you mind if I start with you? I think the most important cause challenge is your first cause challenge. So if within that first 5 minutes, you can get somebody who can say, I just can't be fair and really go after you, the waterfall effect is amazing. I mean, you can get a run real quick in the beginning, and then it's just off to the races from there. The first thing is proving through the jurors themselves that they're not going to get arrested. There's no bailiff that's going to take them to jail if they say, I'm not a good juror on this case. And once you make people comfortable with that, then it's really easy to get cause challenges after that. You have to build a life care plan. And that's one of the most frustrating things that I see with people. Like, I'll get these cases where it's a brain bleed and it's a $2 million life care plan. Like, I spend a lot of time with my life care planner, arguing with them, fighting for my client's future medical care. There's not a case, even like a single level fusion disc bulge. I think that's a $4 million life care plan every single time. It is not all adjacent segment disc disease, one adjacent level fusion, and we're done with it. I wholeheartedly disagree that not all of us can get major life care plans. You just need to put in the time and argue and fight for your client for it. The standard is what they're reasonably certain to need in the future. But what is the definition of what reasonably certain is? My definition is if it'll make them 0.1% better, they get it. Full stop. But the other argument that I have is what is reasonable in the sense of what can we actually sell? I don't put pillows in my life care plans. I don't let doctors do that. A gym membership? Are you kidding me? We should all go to the gym. But no, I mean, if there's regenerative injections that they should get on a monthly basis, I don't care how much they cost. Why shouldn't they get it? We're trying to get them back to where they were before.
If you're enjoying the podcast, the best compliment you can give us is sharing it with a colleague who would find it valuable. For all the best clips from the podcast, follow us on social media. You can find those links in the show notes. Have a jury selection story to share? Email us at podcast@pickingjustice.com and we may address it in a future episode. Until next time, remember, you're not just picking a jury, you're picking justice. Produced and powered by LawPods.